from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a story from Points North, the critically acclaimed final work of fiction by Howard Frank Mosher, published by St. Martin's Press. Howard Frank Mosher was the author of 11 novels and 2 travel memoirs. Born in the Catskill Mountains in 1942, Mosher lived in Vermont's fabled Northeast Kingdom from 1964 to his death in 2017. He won many awards for his fiction, including Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Literature Award, the American Civil Liberties Award for Excellence in the Arts, the Vermont Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts, the New England Book Award, and most recently, the 2011 New England Independent Booksellers Association's President's Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Arts. 4 of his novels, Disappearances, A Stranger in the Kingdom, Where the Rivers Flow North, and Northern Borders, were made into acclaimed feature movies by the Vermont independent filmmaker Jay Craven. Howard Frank Mosher died of lung cancer in January 2017 at the age of 74. This is from the New York Times. Concerned about his health, Mr. Mosher hurried to finish his last book in December. He announced his illness on Facebook on January 22nd, one day after telling followers about the publication of that book. "Well, the best laid plans, as they say," he wrote, adding that he had thought he had an upper respiratory bug, but that it was ultimately diagnosed as cancer. "I am happy to leave you all with the gift of what may be my best book in Points North." In this book, which Publishers Weekly calls Art from Both History and the Quotidian, the story of the Kinnison family, often the focus of Mosher's 4-decade-long career, is brought up to the 21st century. Through a series of stories rooted in northern Vermont, Points North captures the essence of rural America and a way of life fast disappearing all across the country, while celebrating an indomitable human spirit and the magical powers of love. True to his unique style, Mosher leaves us with lyrical prose from a man who missed nothing in nature and was unafraid to confront the more challenging questions of what it means to be human. Points North is both humorous and heartbreaking, and without a wasted word, immerses the reader in Kingdom County, a sliver of America where cold waters, harbor brook trout, small communities fight tooth and nail to maintain their signature individualism, and explorations of family history sometimes lead to unsettling revelations. Written in longhand from the kitchen table of his Vermont home, Mosher finished Points North shortly after his cancer diagnosis at the end of 2016, learning of its acceptance for publication before he passed away, nearly a year to the day ahead of its release. He believed it to be his best work, a fitting culmination to a career spent championing the eccentric, acknowledging that the ugly, jealousy, and racism are as rooted in us as the beautiful, and always believing that the story is what's most important. St. Martin's Press sent me the book before publication, and I asked and received permission to read one of the stories, Where is Don Quixote, on the show. It's a great story. I hope I can do it justice for you today. Where is Don Quixote? A story by Howard Frank Mosher. Elizabeth would have known what to do about the wind towers. Unfortunately, Kinnison's wife had passed a year ago. Passed where? Kinnison had no idea. From time to time, he still heard her voice in his head, calm and practical, but thus far she had said nothing to him about the towers. Elizabeth had been the one person whose opinion, other than Patchett's own, Patchett had the slightest regard for. On those occasions when Kinnison needed to get his hired man into gear, he'd say, "Liz told me we should cut the north hayfield today," or, "Liz said this forenoon would be a good time to start tapping up back." Up back was the maple orchard on the ridge above the barn. As far as Kinnison knew, Patchett himself had never been married. 40 years ago, he'd appeared at Kinnison's door out of a blizzard, sudden as a revenant, a young man with an old man's face. Elizabeth had fed him supper, and he'd stayed on. In time, he'd bought a third-hand Airstream and set up housekeeping in it, between the farmhouse and the hardtop road at the foot of the lane. A month after Patchett had quartered himself on them, Kinnison asked him a question. Was Patchett his first or last name? Patchett had given him a long, slow, wondering look, and neither of them had broached the topic again. Patchett might have known what to do about the wind towers himself. Now an old man with a young man's face, Patchett knew how to fix things. Given time enough and someone to hand him tools and listen to him complain, Patchett could fix anything from a broken flywheel on Kinnison's ancient Oliver tractor to the hard drive of the desktop computer Elizabeth kept the farm accounts on. Quite possibly Patchett could have fixed the wind towers, fixed them in some subtle and untraceable way so that they'd never generate a single kilowatt of green power again. But a few weeks after Liz passed, Patchett had hooked his Airstream behind his pickup and lit out for Big Sky Country. What had caused Patchett to jump ship? Montpelier made him take down his sign beside the hardtop road, claiming that it violated Vermont's anti-billboard legislation. Patchett had written to Montpelier asking how a square of cardboard from a mason shoebox with fish worms for sale and a hand-drawn arrow pointing up at his Airstream could qualify as a billboard. Montpelier did not reply, so Patchett, seeing the handwriting on the wall, hit the high dusty, leaving the offending cardboard sign duct taped to Kinnison's door with the message, "Gone fishing," printed just below the arrow. Patchett, being Patchett, he had not troubled himself to say where he had gone fishing. 10 days later, Kinnison received a postcard from Gulch, Montana, depicting a range of snow-capped mountains that dwarfed Vermont's tallest peaks. It read, "I'm here. Patchett." Kinnison had a grown son in Boston and a grown daughter in New York. After Elizabeth passed and Patchett pulled up stakes and went west, they urged him to unload the farm and move closer to them. Kinnison abided his adult children, as they did him, and enjoyed his grandkids, but if there was one place he detested more than Boston, it was New York. The feeling from Boston was mutual. His was the last working farm in the township of Kingdom Common, and at 80 he couldn't keep up with the twice-a-day regimen of milking 150 cows alone. Therefore, he hired two hard-working Mexican brothers to help run his outfit. Mexicans were already running most of the remaining farms in Kingdom County, and as nearly as Kinnison could tell, running them more efficiently than they had ever been run before. In Kinnison's estimation, the recent influx of Mexican workers was the best thing to happen to the kingdom since his great-great-grandfather, James Kinnison I, and a like-minded handful of James's neighbors had declared its independence from Vermont and the United States and governed it as a freestanding republic for 30 years. A few weeks after Kinnison hired on the Sanchez brothers, the leach field below his farmhouse failed. Juan and Luis could have put in a perfectly serviceable new one for the cost of several truckloads of sand and gravel, a few hundred feet of PVC piping, and the rental of a backhoe for half a day. Before they could get started, someone, Kinnison suspected it was Old Man Potts from over behind, reported the failure of his septic system to the state authorities. In waltzed Montpelier again, this time in the person of a spindling little know-it-all, scarcely out of his teens, who called himself a sanitation hydrologist. Empowered by an abrupt letter from some official or other, the hydrologist made Kinnison install, to the tune of $18,500, a state-of-the-art septic system 30 feet long, 12 feet wide, and 10 feet high, which, in Kinnison's estimation, could have accommodated half of the waste of the village of Kingdom Common. To pay for it, he'd been constrained to cash in a whole life insurance policy whose proceeds, now that Elizabeth was gone, he'd intended to leave in trust with his son and daughter for his grandchildren. Early one evening that summer, Kinnison looked out his kitchen window over the top of the Indian burial mound, as he'd come to think of the new septic system, and saw four coyotes chasing a deer across the water meadow along the river. Before he could load his rifle, they ran her down and tore her to pieces. The next morning, a this year's fawn, still in its spots, tottered into his barnyard. Kinnison put the orphaned animal into an empty stall where the coyotes couldn't get at it, and drove into the common and bought a baby bottle. He coaxed the fawn into lapping a little warm milk off his fingers, then drinking from the bottle. Against the advice of the Sanchez brothers, who had recently moved themselves and their families into two brand-new double-wides near the former site of Patchett's Airstream, Kinnison called the local game warden to report the killing of the doe and his discovery of the fawn. Over the phone line, he heard a sound like a person sucking in air between his teeth. "I wish you hadn't told me that, Zeke," the warden said. the warden called his supervisor in St. Johnsbury, who called the head warden in Montpelier, who showed up at Kinnison's place the next morning with his two subordinates and ordered Kinnison to release the fawn back into the wild and let nature run its course. This Kinnison refused to do. The coyotes who lived on the ridge up back were nearly as large as the timber wolves their ancestors had interbred with, and fully as ferocious, and would snap up an unattended fawn within hours. The head warden shrugged and told his employees to get the deer out of the barn and let it go in the alders beside the river where, the following day, Kinnison came across its bloody hide and partially eaten hooves. Nature had run its course. Above Kinnison's maple sugar orchard, along the ridgeline marking the west boundary of his property, a faint north and south running trace cut through the woods, now mostly overgrown with hobble bush, gray birch, and striped maple. Nearby, at the top of the maple orchard, Kinnison and Elizabeth had placed a granite marker inscribed with their names and birth dates. Here, their ashes would be buried in a single urn, now containing Elizabeth's, which Kinnison kept in the pie safe in her former pantry. The trace, which was known as the Canada Post Road and was owned by the township of Kingdom Common, had been built in 1812 by Kinnison's great-great-great-grandfather, Charles Kinnison I, whose aim it was to attack Canada and annex it to Kingdom County. In the event, Charles and his militia of would-be invaders were driven back across the border by a dozen angry Quebecois habitants, armed with pitchforks and squirrel guns. One afternoon, Kinnison walked up through his maple trees to check on the grave marker. The stone stood where he'd left it, facing out over a prospect of most of the kingdom. It was a beautiful place, but from just down the post road, Kinnison heard voices. Through the underbrush, he made out two men in white hard hats, coming his way with surveying instruments. "Hello, old-timer," one of the surveyors called out. "What brings you up here?" "My grandfather's great-grandfather built this road," Kinnison said. "What brings you up here?" The surveyor handed Kinnison a business card with the words, "Northern New England Green Power," printed on it. He told Kinnison that his company planned to buy the post road from the township and erect 21 wind towers on it. There would be an information meeting at the town hall in Kingdom Common the following Thursday evening. When Kinnison did not favor him with a reply, the surveyor said, "Well, no rest for the wicked," and made a dismissive gesture with the back of his hand, as if to shoo Kinnison off his own property. Kinnison's grandfather would have wrested the surveyor's transit out of his hands and given him a severe drubbing with it. His father, who made it a practice never to leave his house unarmed, would have run off the interlopers at gunpoint. This was a different era. As a rule, Kinnison did not believe in taking the law into his own hands. "Yes, sir, gentlemen," he said, and started back down the slope toward the farmhouse. In general, Ezekiel Kinnison regarded meetings, including Vermont's fabled grassroots town meetings, as a waste of time. In his view, the sole purpose of meetings was to find reasons not to get things done. Patchett had disapproved of meetings, too. It was one of the few things they'd agreed on. Therefore, Kinnison's neighbors were surprised to see him at Thursday's information meeting. "When did you make bail, Z?" Old Man Potts brayed out at him as he entered the hall. Green Power had hired a Burlington law firm specializing in litigating environmental issues. The firm's senior partner, a meticulous man in his 60s, offered the township of Kingdom Common $750,000 for a 2-mile stretch of the Canada Post Road running along the ridge above Kinnison's farm. Kinnison paid little attention to the attorney as he nattered on, and less attention yet to the speeches that followed pro and con from his fellow townspersons. When it was his turn to speak, Kinnison rose and looked around the crowded hall and frowned. "See here," he said. "My name is Ezekiel Kinnison. I own the last working farm in this town. I milk 150 cows, tap 1,000 maple trees, fish the brooks that run off that ridge, and hunt along the post road. I am a seventh-generation commoner who does not care to be told what to do or bribed into doing anything by anyone. For all these reasons, I'm opposed to the towers." Less than 10 minutes later, the town voted 245-181 in favor of selling the post road to the power company. Kinnison went home and wrote a 2-page outraged letter relaying the news to Patchett. A week later, he received a reply on one of Patchett's Big Sky postcards. The message read, "Blow them up, come west."
overnight.
Word spread throughout the kingdom, emanating from the post office like circles on a trout pond, that Kinnison had thrown in with a cadre of eco-terrorists. Report had it that he had driven to New Hampshire, where you could buy, with no questions asked, anything in the way of ordnance necessary to live free or die, and purchased 53 cases of dynamite. Patchett himself was said to be posting east with a posse of mountain men to deal with the as-yet non-existent wind towers. The county prosecutor caught wind of the rumors and wangled an order from the district court judge to send out the sheriff with Dr. Fanny LaFleur Kinnison, the local GP and 3 afternoons a week consulting psychiatrist at the county hospital, to examine Kinnison and determine whether he had gone around the bend and become dangerous to himself or others. Dr. Franny, as she was universally referred to in the kingdom, was Kinnison's great-niece by marriage. She had 2 grown sons herself, but was still, in Kinnison's estimation, as cute as a button. She asked him the day of the week and his date of birth. Then she wanted to know the name of the president. Kinnison winked at her and said Abraham Lincoln. Dr. Franny gave out a raucous belly laugh and snapped off her recording machine and said she only hoped that she'd be as sharp as Kinnison when she was 80. The sheriff, John Uncle Johnny Kinnison, who detested the projected wind towers because they would destroy his secret deer stand on the post road, smiled and drove Dr. Franny back to the village. Several months passed. Everyone from Kinnison's grown children to the local postmistress who'd read Patchett's postcard and ignited the dynamite rumor had advised Ezekiel not to make any life-altering changes during his first year as a widower. Other than hiring on the Sanchez brothers, which Kinnison regarded as the smartest thing he'd done since marrying Elizabeth, he'd made no changes at all. Juan and Luis subscribed to several dairy farming periodicals. They brought in agricultural consultants from the State University and began looking into local VOR projects such as beekeeping, cheesemaking, and raising organically fed beef cattle. Their wives enrolled in community college courses. The children were well-mannered and studious. Kinnison enjoyed taking them fishing and playing catch with them. He liked thinking that they were the future face of the kingdom and wished he could see the expression on old man Potts's face when they grew up to be select persons and road commissioners, school board members, deputy sheriffs, state legislators, members of Congress, and yes, presidents. One of the boys was a gifted ball player. Kinnison envisioned him in pinstripes and a New York Yankees cap, pitching a no-hitter in Fenway Park. In the late afternoons, he sat out on the wraparound porch of the farmhouse where he'd sat evenings helping Elizabeth shell peas and cut up apples, and watched the towers rising ever higher on the ridgetop. "What do you look at, Grandfather?" the Sanchez children inquired. "Those windmills up on the hill," Kinnison said. "Why do you look at them?" "Because they bear watching," Kinnison said, "like you young scamps." By August, all 21 of the towers were in operation. They stood 460 feet high. At night, their red warning lights blinked on and off. More than half of the time, their vast blades were motionless, since the higher mountains immediately to the west blocked the prevailing wind. Nor, Kinnison had recently learned, could the antiquated electrical lines leading to and from the kingdom accommodate more than half of what meager power they generated. Kinnison watched the wind blades not turning. He had never for 1 minute doubted what the scientists said about climate change, but the stationary blades would do little to combat it. Throughout his life, Kinnison had been an avid reader. After Liz passed, he'd had trouble following anything longer than the court news or obituaries in the Kingdom County Monitor. He'd look out the window to check on the wind towers, then return to his book, only to realize that he was rereading the page he had just finished. One afternoon, he found himself in the village library again. Ruth Kinnison, the librarian and Kinnison's second cousin by marriage, was boxing up some outdated westerns for an upcoming book sale. "Welcome, stranger," Ruth said. "What do you hear from Mr. Patchett?" For the briefest moment, Kinnison wasn't sure who she meant. Ruth was the only person who ever referred to his former hired hand as Mr. Patchett. "Not much," Kinnison said, "since that penny postcard got all over town." Ruth smiled. "Mr. Patchett is Mr. Patchett," she said. "I think he always felt the draw of the West." She removed a book from the box, Zane Grey's Riders of the Purple Sage. There was Patchett's name on the checkout card, printed neatly a dozen or so times. "Mr. Patchett read and reread every one of these books," Ruth said. "I'm sure you knew that." Kinnison had known no such thing. He wondered what else there might be about Patchett that he didn't know. After that day many years ago, when he had inquired about Patchett's name, he had never asked him a personal question. Now, looking at Patchett's block printing on the library card, he realized that his friend had not been fleeing anything, including Montpelier and its 1001 regulations, when he'd struck out for Montana. Rather, Patchett had been realizing a lifelong dream. At that moment, Kinnison knew exactly what he must do. That evening, he summoned the Sanchez brothers to the farmhouse kitchen. Without preamble, he said that he was prepared to sell them his 760 acres, the barn and livestock, and the machinery, at assessed or book value. He would hold the mortgage himself, 0% interest, and no down payment. After his death, the monthly payments would go to his son and daughter. He would retain the farmhouse and 2 acres for his children and grandchildren to use as a getaway. Juan and Luis thanked him and said they would keep up the place, of which Kinnison had no doubt. He enjoyed thinking of old man Potts's consternation when he learned that the last working farm in the township was now owned by Mexicans. The brothers returned to their trailers to share the news with their wives. Immediately, Kinnison began packing. He wouldn't need much. His fly rod, deer rifle, winter clothing, and boots. He could bunk in with Patchett, he figured, until he found a place of his own. Late that afternoon, he'd brought the grave marker from the maple orchard down off the ridge on a stone boat behind his Oliver, and gee-hawed it up into the bed of his pickup. He didn't sleep much that night. Except for a year in Korea when he was in the service, he'd spent only a few nights away from his own bed. Now he was leaving the kingdom forever. He imagined that he could hear the low throbbing hum of the windmills. Once he heard Elizabeth say, very distinctly, "A red and yellow grasshopper fly, fished wet, is a good bet out there this time of year." He was up at first light. He limited himself to 1 cup of coffee so he wouldn't have to stop 5 minutes before he was out of Vermont. He removed the urn containing Liz's ashes from the pie safe and wrapped it in his hunting jacket and stashed it in the bottom of the toolbox behind the pickup cab. The rig coughed, ground out, coughed again, and started. He'd have Patchett throw in a rebuilt starter when he arrived. The river was invisible in the September mist. Higher on the ridge, the clouds had dispersed. In the rising sun, the 21 wind towers lit up as red as Armageddon, and the fiery blades began to turn like the big and little wheels of Ezekiel's biblical namesake. Well before he reached the hardtop road where Patchett had started all this with his fishworms sign, Kinnison knew that for him, big sky country was no solution. "How was Montana?" Juan called to him a minute later as he pulled back into his dooryard. "Montana's all right, if you like it," Kinnison said. "It isn't the kingdom." Still, Kinnison realized, as he returned Elizabeth's ashes to the pantry, that it was not his beloved green fields or 100-year-old sugar bush or 6 generations of forebears that had changed his mind about leaving the kingdom. What brought him back was the wind towers. Looking up at their blades looming high above the county in the mild fall sunlight, like so many winged alabaster idols, Kinnison pursed his lips. As he'd told the Sanchez children, the towers bore watching. It had fallen to him to watch them. That might not be much, but it was the one thing left in this world that he was certain of. I hope you enjoyed that reading of Where is Don Quixote by Howard Frank Mosher from his book Points North, published by St. Martin's Press. You can find my 2009 interview with Howard Frank Mosher on the podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt, drawing from the last sentence of Howard Frank Mosher's story, Where is Don Quixote, is to write about the one thing left in this world that you are certain of. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So that's it for now. We will be playing some music for the second half of today's show. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.